Hi, everybody. This is Steven Skaya, film, television, writer, producer. You are listening to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Hello, dear reader. Hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 21 of the Handsome Timmy D Express. I hope y'all had an absolutely wonderful Thanksgiving and are slowly crawling out of your food comas. I want to thank everybody else, everybody who shared and retweeted and participated in Snack Friday. It's always just a good, right thing to do at this time of year to give what you can to some local charities and those in need, because after all, you never know when you might be the one who's in need, if there's one thing we've learned from the Great Recession. But on to happier times, and thanks everybody for spreading the word about Player Piano and things like that, and their Indiegogo campaign and all that. Those are amazing videos, so I'm so glad people are spreading the word on that. Very excited to welcome today an actress who you have seen in The L Word, Smallville, Battlestar Galactica, and her latest project is a movie, an independent film, a comedy slash drama slash comedy, called Life Partners, that is already available on iTunes, but is going to be released in theaters this Friday, December the 5th. Welcome to the Handsome Timothy Express, Simone Bailey.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And I kind of paused when I said actress there because I'm kind of iffy and I want to be sensitive. I'm
because you really wanted to say actress extraordinaire.
I did want to say actress extraordinaire. But I know that you're, I don't want to, hurt your humility there. But is actress still an acceptable form, or should we be saying actor? Does it matter?
Well, it's funny because for many years I was like, I'm an actor. Mm-hmm. Because I was very adamant about that. And then, I don't know, you just watch so many Oscar shows and you're like, okay, well, they keep saying actress. So then I just started saying actress.
Well, I admit to being a little sensitive about it. Like I said, I kind of paused and I was like, ooh, should I say, oh, I just went with it. We could edit it. Because I think there's no, I don't mean anything demeaning by it. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that helps it a bit. I don't know. Maybe it's a personal preference thing. I certainly don't mean anything bad by it, and I'm happy to address whoever, however they want to be addressed.
But I think both are perfectly acceptable.
Okay, rock and roll.
Yeah.
So tell us about, since Life Partners is coming out this week, why don't we start there? Tell us about Life Partners and what that experience was like.
Okay, so Life Partners is about two best friends, played by Leighton Meester and Gillian Jacobs, who basically hit a speed bump in their friendship when one of them gets romantically involved, and so they have to renegotiate the terms of their friendship. But it's really funny, very relatable, has a lot of wry humor, and really sweet. It's a really great movie. I've seen it now twice, because we had a premiere. We were selected to open Outfest LA in July, and so we opened there and had 2,000 people in the audience, and that was incredible. I was asked to come up on stage with the director and writers. It was directed by a female director, wonderful director, named Susanna Fogel, and she co-wrote it with Joni Leifkowitz, and it started as a one-act play that was then selected to be a Sundance Lab film. And so it was developed at Sundance, and then it turned into a feature. And when I auditioned, it was kind of funny because I had two auditions that day, and it was one of those, okay, I'm going to drive across town, do my audition, then quick change, go to the second one. And so the first one was, kind of like, meh, meh. And I was like, okay, I got to go to the second. So change into a suit, go there. And, it's a room full of women, producer, director, all that awesome stuff. And I just thought, you know what? I'm just going to be myself and make them laugh and really have fun. And I did. And it was great. And that's the part I got.
Wow.
And at the time, I didn't even know who was in the cast. And I really liked the script. I thought it was really witty and fun and relatable and all those great things. And I got the cast list and it was like, oh yeah, you're acting with Leighton Meester and Gillian Jacobs and Adam Brody. And other cast members are Gabourey Sidibe and Julie White, who I had been watching from Go On, and Greer Grammer, who's Kelsey Grammer's daughter, and all these like amazing people like Kate McKinnon, who's just killing it on SNL right now. And Abby Elliott as well. Just like a really amazing cast. So it was a real honor and privilege to be part of that mix.
And I think that's a great lesson to sort of go in and be yourself. And it's funny because it's interesting to hear that from an actor who sometimes we think of you guys as like, you got to have a million masks on and a million different ways of saying something or doing something. But that's interesting to hear. No, just go in and just be honest and be yourself.
And that's actually one of the hardest lessons I learned as an actor. Coming from theater, I used to pride myself on being a chameleon and being a character actor. And every time I'd show up on stage, you know, I'd kind of want you to not be able to tell it was me. And, you know, and it was great. And I, you know, did many years in theater. And then I switched to film. And it, oddly enough, it was my mother who said, well, I don't know why you're always doing all these voices and all these, you know, like you're doing all these wild characters. Like, what's wrong with just being you? And I actually had to take an inventory on myself. And I thought, I don't know, kind of scares me to just be me. Like, who am I? And so there were many years of trying to figure out, like, would people even like hearing my real voice? Right. And then, you know, all these kind of things. But one of the greatest compliments I had when I was working on The L Word, I remember the sound guy said to me, he goes, Simone, can I talk to you for a second? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I listen to voices all day long. You know, that's my job. And he goes, I'm telling you, you have the most incredible voice. You could make $1 million with your voice. And I thought, what? That's so crazy. Like, I just couldn't believe that someone would say that about me. And especially like a professional who just sits there and that's his job, you know?
Well, this podcast will be broadcasting it since it's audio only. And I'm glad I got you before you're charging $1 million.
Sorry. Oh, by the way, I didn't mean that to sound braggy.
No. No.
Explain like how I used to hide behind the mask of characters, and then all of a sudden I kind of just relaxed into being more myself in my character or in my portrayal of characters.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, and no, I don't think you're bragging at all, because I actually wrote in my Austin Film Festival preview blog, I wrote as just a little primer for other writers going out to Austin. We could even talk about that since you guys were there a couple years ago.
I love Austin.
But I wrote like, hey, don't forget, it's okay to be a good writer. You know, it's okay to feel like you're a good writer. If you've been recognized as a second rounder or a finalist, semifinalist, you can tell people you're pretty good as a writer. Doesn't mean you're being an arrogant, you know, prick by saying that. It's okay to feel a recognition. I think that sometimes it's a great point you bring up, because we sometimes feel too self-conscious, like, oh, I don't want to be that jerk, I don't want to brag. But when in this business, which is so tough and so hard, when somebody gives you a compliment, you take it. You run with it, because you may need that to build your career upon. Like you said, now you have validation as far as a whole other avenue of your career that maybe you said you weren't thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The something else I want to touch upon there is just to go back to Life Partners for a second. Something that gets brought up specifically, I want to talk about this for screenwriters just for a minute. It's often brought up like, oh, well, I don't know how to write a screenplay or whatever. And a lot of people are saying, well, just write a play. You could write a play, and sometimes those do get read by showrunners and people in rooms. And this is a great example. Life Partners, a show that's. Here's an actual show that started off as even a small one-act play and now has all the way blossomed into a widely released independent film. So now you've worked on some pretty big shows too. You have a pretty not too shabby resume yourself, Simone, let's be honest. I mean, you've worked on some really big shows. L Word had a huge budget. Battlestar Galactica had a huge budget. But Life Partners, I'm under the impression, was a pretty small budget indie. Kind of, would you say it was like guerrilla style or...?
Yeah, I mean,
which can be wicked fun.
I saw an interview on YouTube when they were doing a Q&A, because, you know, the movie, you know, it was at Tribeca this year, and it kind of made the rounds all over the States. And I think one of our producers' steakhouse was talking about how one day they didn't have a permit for something, and she got, pulled over by the cops, and that was quite hilarious. But yeah, I mean, the film, I think, shot in 20 days and then some additional pickup days. So, you know, you're moving really quick. But there's always that great camaraderie on independent films where everyone's working together, and, you know, you're really in in it for the love of the game. Like, we didn't have fancy catering, but we had great, you know, catering, and everything was just enough, you know?
Right. Well, I think also, too, how important is the, you said camaraderie, or some people call it chemistry. I mean, that's really got to carry you through sometimes, long days, and, you know, because if it's a small budget, that means not just catering is being cut back, but probably some fees and stuff are being cut back as well.
Yeah, like, there were no fancy trailers. I was fortunate, like, I was, all my scenes were with Adam and Leighton and Gillian and some other great cast members. And, you know, we were just hanging out on location in the back of a house, in a guest house, and just, you know, shooting the breeze. And it was really, really cool, actually. It was a real honor to get to know those actors. I actually wasn't overly familiar with Adam's work, even though all my girlfriends swoon over him in the OC. But, you know, he was just such a really cool, intelligent guy to talk to. And Gillian, I mean, she's hilarious on Community. That was really fun. And Leighton, you know, she's a sweetheart. And it was cool, too, because they, Leighton and Adam were just dating at the time, and, you know, now they're married, so there's kind of that fruition in real life, you know. It's just, it was a neat time, and it was a really cool project to work on. Susanna, the director, was, like, she had a great script, her and Joni, but she also wasn't overly precious. She would kind of, you know, give a take where it's like, yeah, you know, just have whatever you want kind of take, and it was great. And I love that. Like, it really felt collaborative.
Right. So you felt like, because I always feel like that's a challenge for directors and writers and actors, is making sure everybody's able to bring out their own creativity while maintaining a singular vision, if that makes sense. And that sounds like you guys were all able to throw in your two cents and try different things. Is it more fun sometimes? Like, I don't know. I mean, hey, we all want the air-conditioned trailer and filet mignon every day at lunch, but that sounds fun, you know? Hey, let's go to the guest house for the weekend and just make a movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the director wasn't always, was, and the line producers were pulling their hair out some days, I'm sure, as it is on every shoot, but, like, it just sounds like that stuff can be more fun.
Absolutely. Like, that's one of the other things I love about film is the social aspect. And, you know, there's been days where I've been in a trailer and I have an amazing trailer and living the dream and, oh my God, I'm cast, you know, and you're just sitting around, you know, it's just like, oh God, you know, and, yeah, it's just, every experience is unique. And yeah, sometimes you can have even more fun on an independent.
Yeah.
I mean, usually, like, for me, though, it has to have an amazing script and or great people to work on independents now. Because I, you know, usually when you start, you kind of get your acting chops and your credits from a lot of independent stuff, and some of it is a little like, you know.
No, I know.
So, you know, I think there's a trust factor there now for me to accept roles on certain things.
Meaning, like, trust factor, like trust in the script?
Absolutely, in the script and the people.
Right. Do you think, and this is maybe a question a lot of writers may not want to hear the answer to, do you think a good cast with good chemistry can make a, I don't think you could necessarily save a bad script, but can a good cast with good chemistry sort of take a mediocre or good script and make a great movie out of it? Or do you think that's almost, like, the script has to be, you know, pretty much there?
That is tricky, because
there's no wrong answer. I don't know. I just thought
of it. I will say that even even some of the best, biggest blockbusters are beloved by fans, but I might not necessarily love it. And there's, you know, some of that happening actually right now in theaters, where people are going nuts over certain films, and I'm just like, really?
Yeah.
So I think these films over here are pretty amazing, and they might not be getting as much recognition, but...
No, very true.
You know, like,
but
Saint
they're
Vincent.
There if you look.
Have you seen St. Vincent? What a great, great film.
No,
Fox
I haven't.
Foxcatcher, holy smokes.
The I'm other dying day, to see Foxcatcher.
Oh,
well, I'm as a wrestling guy, I remember reading all that stuff when it happened, so I can't wait.
I was so fortunate. The other day, So I had my premiere at the Arclight Hollywood on Tuesday. On Wednesday, I was back at the Arclight Hollywood going to a special screening of Foxcatcher with the director, Bennett Miller, in attendance. So he's directed Capote and what was the other great one? Ah, he's done so many great things. But, you know, like he's directed five films or so in mm-hmm. his career, but just all amazing. And then Channing Tatum was there. And Steve Carell. And that was like, what a treat. Anyway, the film is incredible, and I recommend everyone to go see it. It's definitely going to be...
Yeah, Moneyball was the big one that Bennett
made. Oh, yeah, Moneyball.
Yeah, amazing. Of course. I think Channing Tatum is awesome. I really do. I know a lot of people are kind of down on him, but I 21 Jump Street, I'm like, he can do no wrong. I loved him.
I love those movies. Yeah. So, yeah.
And what I love, the story you just told, and I think this is sometimes for me, actually one of the hardest challenges for me, but I've not lost it yet. I love the fact that you're talking about going to a premiere of one of your movies one night as a participant, you know, as somebody who was one of the artists that helped make it. And then the next night you're going to see another great movie, but as a fan. And yeah. I think that's important to maintain that we're all still fans underneath. We're all still doing this because we love it and we want to see great stuff.
Yeah. And then the next night I went to see some theater and I saw Kinky Boots, which was amazing.
Oh yeah, that's on the list too.
Playing at the Pantages Theater. And then yesterday, I mean, not to brag again, I'm just telling you like, wow, what a amazing, enriching week I've had. You know, yesterday I was so fortunate I got to go to the Disney lot and watch Into the Woods, and Joss Whedon is sitting in front of me and you know, we get to do a via satellite Q&A with Meryl Streep and all these amazing cast members, you know, on the panel live from New York. I mean, it was just like, what? This is crazy. So, you know, I pinch myself all the time.
That's awesome. No, it's true. Yeah. Because Hollywood is an awesome place. You know, the business is what you make of it. I really believe that. If you're bitter and depressed and just frustrated all the time, then it's going to be an awful business. But if you're gracious and always got your eyes open and looking for opportunity, the business is going to be wonderful. And I think that's a great example of that.
Yeah.
Something I want to touch back on, though. I don't know if we can get too specific about it, but when you say a great script, now it's easy to say. It's funny. I went to a Q&A with a very established writer named Rocky Soban, and he said, hey, making it in TV writing is easy. Just write really great stuff. And mm-hmm. he's right. But like, what in your mind constitute, like an aspiring reader, a screenwriter is listening to this mm-hmm. and they want to make an independent movie. They have an idea that's like, oh, if I could get this movie off the ground, I want to get in the Sundance Lab or whatever. Mm-hmm. What constitutes a great script? Is it the dialogue, the character, the story, all the above? Like, what is it you look for in a script?
Right. So it's a culmination of things, in my opinion.
Sure.
I think having a strong story arc, starting from point A and then, you know, going through a series of challenges and you know, falls and dusting yourself and getting back up again, and then finally coming to a very, very different place at the end. So strong story arc. An element of surprise or many. I think Breaking Bad, for instance, is so incredible. If you look at the way every single scene is just like, it's so much tension, and then a big reveal, and then it's like you've got that checkmate moment at the end of wow. each scene where you're just like, drop the mic and walk away, and you're like, oh my God, that's so crazy. So, you know, elements of surprise. Definitely, when you're writing, think about the characters as every single character is the lead of their own story.
Right. So what, I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like what, cause that's what we do as actors, you know, like there's no small parts, right? That's what they say. So yeah, I would really think about it, and also think about, is this believable? I mean, one thing that turns me off is if I'm reading a monologue and it's just for the sake of a monologue, it's like, well, what is the character actually trying to achieve? Like, what do they want? Why are they saying this? What are they fighting for? And another thing that is something that was very helpful that I learned in acting school, but I think it relates to writing as well. They would say, if you are being chased by a bear and there's a cabin right there where you're going to run over to safety, don't play the bear, play the cabin. Because that's where you're trying to go for safety. You're not like, oh my god, the bear. Oh my god, the bear is really coming. You know. So what does the character do to get what they want, and what lengths will they go to get what they want? Also, like, tension is very good. Dramatic tension. Two characters in a scene, and they both want something, but they're both not getting it. That can be incredibly delicious, you know, things like that. So, you know, every character has their agenda, and as actors, it's our job to bring that to life. I think, yeah, curveballs in scenes. Another thing I personally would wish for is to stop making women helpless victims. That drives me nuts, because I think there's got to be some sense of fight or intelligence or something.
Yeah. No, and I think that very much the backlash against that is really growing strong. I, for one, am super excited about the new Ghostbusters. And you know what's crazy is the fact that they announced it's going to be an all-female cast with Paul Feig directing it, if I'm saying his name right. That's why I'm like, okay, now I'm sold.
Yeah.
Because I would much rather see Kristen Wiig and whoever it is, and Simone Bailey kick ass as Ghostbusters, than I don't want to see 75-year-old Ghostbusters. I don't want to see old men Ghostbusters. And neither do they. Bill Murray came out and said, no, this is a great idea. Yeah. And I think the backlash against that is really because it's not even realistic anymore. We don't even know those women who are I can't even think of a helpless woman in my life, period. You know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't ring true. That is now falling into that unbelievable category.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think it's happening more and more and more, and we're seeing it happen more and more. And even looking at Guardians of the Galaxy, the Zoe Saldana character was not the lead. And she was still the love interest, but she kicked the hell out of everybody in that movie and was smart and intelligent and actually, you know, one of the integral people that saved the day. She was Han Solo, basically, whereas Pratt was Luke Skywalker. And mm-hmm. It totally freaking worked. I think it's fascinating that when I asked you that, what do you look for in a good script? You actually started, your first thing you said was a strong story arc. Do you care, like, it's one of those things, there's always those stories about actors who count their pages or count their lines. It doesn't sound like you're one of those people. Like, is it more important to be involved in just a really great project, no matter the size? Like, or would you rather be like a lead in something that wasn't so good, if that makes sense?
I think the first.
Yeah.
I think you can do a lot with a shorter page count.
Mm.
And even, you know, some of the biggest blockbusters, sometimes it's that one, even the one-liner, you're like, oh, that person just killed it, you know, because they were like, they had the funny line or the, you know, aha moment or the whatever, and it's just, you know, and those are the performances sometimes that really stick out. So I think, yeah, I'd rather not be in a crappy thing and be on screen for a really long time in a crappy movie, if I can help it. But, yeah.
Now, can I out who your husband is?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I had your husband, Stephen Sky, on a few episodes ago, and I want to touch upon the fact that he and I talked about this, and I think it's true that, like, I think it's a line that's almost often made fun of, and I'm so glad you talked about it at length, and let's touch upon it some more, because I think it's that important, is what's my motivation? Because we talked about, like, Steve and I talked about, like, if there's something really wrong with your script and you don't know what it is, stop and really look at your character. And are your characters truly behaving and acting toward their goals and to their motivation? Because if they're not, the script is going to not ring true and not fall apart. I think that is the absolute most, quite frankly, probably the most important thing in any script. What is that character doing? Why are they trying to get it so bad? And what are the things that are standing in their way? And it sounds like for an actor, that's the same exact priority.
Yeah, because the script essentially is a constant reveal of character. And, oh, well, now the game has changed because the character just did this. I mean, look at House of Cards, okay? So Kevin Spacey shoots a dog in the first scene. And, you know, luckily I went to a Q&A of that as well, where Kevin was commenting on that, you know, there's a line of thinking which is like, oh my God, you know, we're going to have a lot of viewers turn off this show because, you know, we've now killed a dog in the first couple minutes. But at the same time, it's an incredible reveal of this character.
Right.
You know, and that's what you want. I mean, I remember in my theater days too, they would say every scene should have purpose and there's nothing that doesn't propel you into the next scene. And it's all important. So as writers, especially if you're newer to writing, don't be lazy and also start to think from a producer's perspective, like what is this location going to be like, or but also be malleable too, to be open to different things.
Yeah.
But what, you know, first I guess you have to know, okay, am I going to make what I'm writing into a short film and it's my dime and all that kind of stuff? Okay, well then I have to write it a certain way. I might, you know, scrimp on certain things and all that. But if you really just want to go for you know, go for the gold and just write what you want to write. I mean, yeah, like make it juicy, make it exciting, make it dangerous, make it, you know, twists and turns and unexpected and all those, you know, wonderful things.
Well, I think something too that helps that and to speak to what you just said about, you know, trying our best not to be lazy, though for some of us it's second nature. And I think you mentioned each scene has an important thing, and let's, you know, I think as an actor you'll agree, each line, even it's not to drive yourself crazy over it, but lines should not just be there. Lines should be driving the story forward, and each line should be driving the character's motivation. Even if I'm walking the room, like you and I are in a scene together, right? And I walk in the room, and I have the line, "Good morning," and you have the line, "How are you?" There should be some sort of underlying tension in there. Are you mad at me? Did I steal something from you? Are you going to fire me? And are we nervous? And that changes the whole performance of "Good morning" and "How are you?" Does that make sense?
Absolutely. But also remember, there's a lot of power in silences.
Yes, very true. And that's a hard thing to kind of write and for aspiring screenwriters remember of like, oh, I have to fill the page. And it's like, no, you really don't.
Yeah, and even, you know, when I was doing my Shakespeare training, and Shakespeare, if you look at his writing, he wrote in iambic pentameter, which is a certain rhythm of writing, but even down to his punctuation and capitalization in the old folio texts, sometimes he would write a line short because the meter of the, like, the rhythm of the sentence is silence. And there's power in that. Anyway, whether you understand what I just said or not, play the silences, and there's a lot of power in that. So sometimes, you know, I think newer writers have the tendency to just go on and on and on, but it's like, no, you don't necessarily need a huge, giant monologue for the sake of, you know, telling us how hard her life was or, you know, whatever it is. Like, you know, sometimes there's magical moments in saying little.
And, you know, another, if you don't need to understand Shakespeare, I think, to get that, because I think it's a great point. But also think about, like, your own fights that you get in with your significant other or your family or your best friend. There's always a pause where you both run out of what to say or can't think of what to say. And that usually is when you're dealing with your emotions. It's a very powerful moment, both in real life and in drama. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really fantastic point. One of there's a British actress named Louise Jameson, and she said, I'm not going to get the exact quote right, so Louise, my apologies if I mess this up, but she said something like, the white space is where the actors do the work on the page. You know what I mean? Like, that's when the more white space on the page, almost the more work we can do to sort of find the subtext and tension. And I think that's an important reminder.
Yeah.
A quick little Shakespeare thing. One of my favorite things he did was in Richard III, which is one of the great plays ever.
Love. But absolutely.
In the beginning, he sets up his brother George, because I forget the exact detail, but the king has a vision that his killer begins with the letter G. So he has George, Duke of Clarendon, locked up. But Shakespeare, in the text, didn't write Richard III as the line. It didn't say Richard says this, Richard says that. It said Gloucester. because he's Richard Duke of Gloucester. So if you read the text, that's the giveaway, that the killer begins with the letter G instead of George. I just, even in that detail, it's just insane. So good.
Yeah, I always say, if, you know, people, I don't know, have you ever been asked, like, hey, if you were on a deserted island, like, what book would you have with you?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And my answer is always the complete works of Shakespeare, because I just think that is just the ultimate book.
That's,
to have.
It's all of them.
I mean, maybe a survival guide would also be helpful, but, you know, if you
it'll be in there. It'll be in there. Titus will have something in there. Titus Andronicus, I think. But watching Much Ado About Nothing, the Kenneth Branagh movie, I was not at all familiar with Much Ado About Nothing when I saw it, and I was like, this is every sitcom I've ever seen. It's just the confusion and the overhearing and the blah, 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 and just the complete and utter misunderstanding that leads to antics and hijinks. And I'm like, this is the very first sitcom. It's crazy. Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say, BuzzFeed did a whole thing a while back. I mean, other sites too, I'm sure. But they talk about, like, this film you'd never believe was actually a Shakespeare play. You know, like the story concept.
Oh, sure, yeah. Like the 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yeah, 10 Things I Hate About You, and, you know, other ones as well.
They're kind of all a Shakespeare in one degree or another, I think.
Well, but even Strange Brew, they said, was it Hamlet?
It might have been. I'm not the biggest Strange Brew.
I mean, it was just so obscure. I was like, oh, I never thought about that. That's so weird, but, yeah. Anyway.
That's great. So, let's talk, though, about, like, I don't know if I'm going to say this question right, but sort of I'm just sort of, like, wondering, like, when you get a script, you know, I think a writer often fears, oh, God, the actor is going to change all of my lines, and sometimes that happens. But is that something that, quite frankly, isn't always necessarily a bad thing? Like, how much experience have you had where you've gotten a script and you're like, this all makes sense on the page, but you can't say it, and we have to, like, rework it to a degree? Or, I don't know, you were talking about with Life Partners, how, like, there was some wiggle room and some suggestions. What's sort of that process like, where you're trying to, you know, make the lines better without sort of cutting the knees off of the writer, if that makes sense?
Okay, well, there's a few lines of thinking, and there's also a few lines of thinking depending on the actor. But I try not to be a douchebag, so I will always
good advice.
So I will always, firstly, and maybe it's because I come from theater, and you always aim to be word perfect because you're doing a performance, and, you know, there's no second takes. So typically, if you're doing television, you have to be word perfect more often than not. And then if you're doing a feature, there is a little more wiggle room. And then in my experience, if I was doing an independent, I feel more comfortable maybe jamming with the people, depending on, you know, the vibe I get from them.
Right.
And how comfortable I feel, then perhaps I will say, hey, you know, how about this? Or if they open it up to me and say, this little monologue you have, like, is there a better way that you feel more comfortable delivering this, like saying different words or whatever? And I'll be like, oh, sure. But I try not to change it. I try to make it work as best as possible. And the other day, it was funny, I had an audition. And I just really wanted to do the audition. But it really was not a great script. And when I get things like that across my desk, I'm like, oh, is it me? Like, am I just missing something here? And so I'll reread it. I mean, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'll just say, I'm sorry, you know, this project isn't for me. But this one, I was like, okay, I was determined to make it work. And I finally did make it work, even though it wasn't, you know, great material. But I've also been on sets in TV and features where actors with bigger credits will step on to set once everyone's in place and show up and fluff their feathers. And you know, I've witnessed people say, you know, to the director, oh, this is what should happen in the scene, and da-da-da-da-da, and they start ordering people around. Mm-hmm. I've even witnessed people give actors line reads, which is a huge no-no, like actor to actor, like typically you know what I mean? It's like, if they didn't ask for your opinion, like, don't give it to them. And I think that that's pretty gross to do that. I've also seen actors come in and kind of cut out lines that this poor day player was really excited to do, and they come on set and they're like, no, let's just cut that person's line. Well, okay, you cut that person's line, you also cut their job. Yeah, thanks a lot, asshole. Yeah. You know, so there's, I don't know, I don't really think you should be messing with script unless that door is ajar and, you know, your input is welcome in that way, because there's time, you know, time is money, and the engine's moving and you're slowing stuff down. I mean, you know, you got to kind of feel it out, but I think I wouldn't recommend doing that. I think it's pretty douchey.
no arguments here.
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, there are a lot of stories like that that we hear about, and unfortunately on some sets they're true. And one of my favorite sayings I heard from a director once was, when they're on the top, they're great. When they're on the bottom, they're great. It's when they're in the middle. You're not sure about where they're going, and there's some insecurity. But anyway, we're not name-dropping anybody. But I do want to talk about, now you've been acting for quite a long time. You have a hell of a resume. You are an established actor extraordinaire. But
Esquire.
Let's talk about the audition process for a second, because that is one of the things, like, when you're on the outside looking in and sort of aspiring to get in the business, I think there's this sort of myth that, like, oh, well, one day I'll make it. And quite frankly, we're all always still trying to make it. You know, I could think of several, like, people who have made millions of dollars in the business who have given interviews where they're like, nope, I'm still trying to make it. You know, Ozzy Osbourne once said he never made an album as good as Sgt. Pepper, so he's always trying. So I'd love to talk about the audition process for a second. Like, you still have to go through, do you still get, like, nervous? And is the audition process still, like, a nerve-wracking thing? Is that, like, one of the hardest things about being an actor, is the constant proving ground?
Yeah, I think so. And my dad and mom always say to me, like, I gotta commend you for doing what you do. Like, that's basically like going into a job interview pretty much like every day of your life. Yeah. And like, you don't even get rejected. Like, you don't even hear you only hear if you got it, but otherwise you just, you know, and don't really hear much. And you rarely get feedback too. So,
sometimes you're lucky enough just to be one of the people called into audition. I mean, isn't that sometimes, it's not like anybody can just show up and be like, oh yeah, you know, put myself forward for some of these parts.
Right. It's a big deal to even be granted the opportunity to audition, because they get tons of people, you know, tons of submissions, and they're just like, nope, nope, nope. And typically, casting directors have their stable of actors that they know of, that they trust, and, you know, they know aren't going to, you know, metaphorically crash the car. So they bring them in, and it's like, okay, you know, keep the train moving, because they have a job to do as well. And it was a lot easier for me in Vancouver, working on all of the American projects that filmed in Vancouver. I was kind of a bigger fish there, and coming to LA, where I went from basically, maybe 10 or so, give or take, casting directors in Vancouver to now, you know, well over 100. I mean, wow. I don't even know exactly how many casting directors there are here, but it's like, how do you even get to know anyone?
Yeah.
You know, it's tricky. So, but I've been really fortunate. And yes, it sucks auditioning at times. Sometimes it's really fun. And basically, I think it was Benicio del Toro once said, you know, I basically do my interpretation of the character and I present it to you. If you get what I'm doing and you like what I'm doing, then we'll work together. And if you don't get it or whatever, you know, it's fine. I'll save my energy and put it somewhere else. But I mean, you can't really go in wanting the job. You have to just do your best performance. And there's like so many factors that come into play of why you maybe aren't cast. Like, this girl, Amy Jo Berman, who's a casting director, she did 26 reasons why you didn't get the part. You know, you're too tall, you're too short, you're too pretty, you're not pretty enough, like, you're too fat, you're too thin, you're too blonde, you know, like, it goes on and on, and you're like, oh my God, you know, like, you look like the director's wife, you know, and he doesn't love his wife right now, or, you know, whatever it is. Like, there's so many, and, so many things.
And so much of that stuff on that list you really can't change. You kind of can't, so you, like, you almost have, is there, do you have to just sort of, like, do you guys have to sort of enter, like, as, and we do as writers too, but, like, just to talk about actors for a second, like, enter a zen state of that's, well, that's the way it is. Because you can't make yourself taller, some, I mean, maybe you could put on heels, but, like,
yeah, you there's know, lots I can of tricks. Of, absolutely.
But, like, but there's things you can't change that are just like, well, you know, fair enough, I'm just not going to get that role, so I, because you can make yourself crazy. Like, if you take all of these non-callbacks and rejections personally and try to twist and turn yourself into something you're not, that could be a really schizophrenic life, you know what I mean?
But I like to do, I have a new game I like to play, which is sometimes I will, you know, if you're at an audition and you see the other girls there, you're like, okay. And I kind of like, even though I probably shouldn't, I kind of size some of the girls up and I'm like, okay, I see she's probably going to play it this way. That girl's probably going to do that. Okay. Da, 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 da. And I'm like, I'm going to do this. And, you know, there was a feature film that the breakdown said they want. At the time, they wanted a ditzy blonde, and I was going out for the role, and I'm like, okay, well, right off the cuff, I'm not blonde, and I thought, ditzy blonde, come on, like, we could do better than that. So I reimagined the character and did my own take on her, and the very first audition for this I had, the director was there in attendance, and you could, I started, and you could see him looking at me going like, what the F are you doing? And then you see this, you're like, his eyes went wide, and then he like put his palm to his face and leaned in, and he's like, ooh, this is actually really interesting.
Yeah.
And so I ended up getting the part, and he met with me and he said, I gotta say, like, I loved your interpretation of this role. And he rewrote the whole thing to like customize it to what I was doing. And that's when you can do something like that, like, that's great. Like, that's art, you know? It's a lot of fun. So sometimes, yeah, you just gotta be a little different. And there's times where I've heard casting people say, oh, every girl who came in was in a black tank top, had just one girl wore red. Like, my God, like, we're so sick of seeing, you know, cause sometimes they see, you know, 2 days of people or more, and they're just seeing like person after person after person, like, for a role.
The, a couple different thoughts there. It's really interesting. Now, how big a risk is that though? Like, let's say the casting director turned around and said, oh my God, get her the hell out of here and I never want to see her again.
That did happen. That happened to me once where I was going out for a movie and I decided to take a risk. And, you know, it's a risk because it's a risk. That's what it is. And I was playing a flight attendant. And I had, in real life, I had been actually doing a lot of flights back and forth from the States to Canada. But this was when I was still living in Canada.
Right.
So I was going out for this big franchise of a feature film franchise that was filming in Vancouver. And so I showed up with this pretty, because I had, in real life, I had seen a flight attendant that had this wacky makeup on. And she had an American accent that was, you know, I found kind of interesting. And so I went in and I basically did her. Well, my agent at the time got a phone call from casting and it was basically like, what was she doing?
Wow.
Like, your actor, you know, Simone is way better than this. Like, I didn't even get what she was doing. And it's like, okay, well, she thought I was just like, didn't know what I was doing. It's actually the opposite. Every single thing I did was very intentional. And so that's an example of taking a big swing. And in her eyes, I missed because she didn't get what I was doing. And that's fine. And, you know, it burnt for a second. And you know, I was like, okay, well, you know, so there's, it's just, yeah.
But you still advocate it's a good idea to take some risks here and there.
Well, I mean, you have to, you know, like, Bryan Cranston says, create a compelling character that serves the text.
Mm.
You know, present it in the environment where your audition happens and then walk away. Let it go. Like, you just, that's all you can do is, you know, to the best of serving the text, really.
One of my favorite casting clothing stories, though, is Sylvester McCoy when he was cast as Seventh Doctor in his audition wore a Panama hat with a red handkerchief around it. And sure enough, when they offered him the role of the Doctor, they said, can he bring the hat? And that became the Doctor's hat. So the clothing is actually quite important in some of those things. Very interesting that we as writers don't think of. You know, we're trying to make that text. So,
yeah.
Wow.
Oh, I'm very into clothing. Like, clothing to me is always the gateway into the character. And, you know, down to the shoes. Shoes are a big tell of what your character is. And I will even go so far as to dress down to the undergarments. Because that, I you wouldn't think it. You're like, oh, that sounds weird. But actually, it does inform your character. I mean, if you're wearing
everything, yeah.
Well, if you're wearing full back panties versus thigh high stockings, I mean, that right there. If you're wearing no bra versus padded bra, or, you know, saggy boob, or, you know, whatever it is. Like, everything, I mean, there's just, everything informs the character.
Absolutely. And it's an interesting point. I've often heard things like, sometimes when you're stuck on a character, I've heard tips like, what newspaper do they read? What CDs are they listening to? Or MP3s in this day and age? What books are they reading? What underwear are they putting out for themselves? Those are actually important things. I'm trying to be really mature about this conversation. They're all important motivations.
But that is what is so hard about auditioning is that, you know, people don't understand that often we are given sometimes like, you know, a few hours notice for something. Like, I'll get a call late at night for an 11 pager audition for the early morning. And it's like, okay, so had you just given me, I mean, you know, I'll do it and comply obviously and do my best, but you know, the more time I have, the more layers I can put on it and make it a richer performance. And so sometimes you're really limited by time. And there was one day I remember in Vancouver where I had three back-to-back auditions at one casting office that was like one of my main casting places. And every audition was over, you know, 10 pages or something. Like, I had to learn like 29 pages. And I know, yes, soap opera actors do that, and that's extraordinary on a daily basis. But when you're doing procedural and you're doing jargon and you're doing lawyer auditions or whatever it is, it can be very challenging because I have to basically get a script and be an expert on whatever it is. Okay, now I'm this type of doctor, I'm this lawyer, I'm this whatever, or I'm, you know, on this planet. And it's like I have to just go with it and make it real and present it, you know. And so there was one day I was there for 7 hours or something at this casting office, and the assistant sat there and she kind of realized after the second one, she's like, oh God, like we called you in on a lot of roles today. Wow. And I was like, yep, you know, but I just sucked it up and did it, you know, because what else do you do? It's a fantastic opportunity, but it is tough. And like, forget dinner plans. I mean, you know, you just have to, you know, and you get nervous. I know lots of girls have meltdowns. I mean, actors too, I'm sure, have meltdowns before auditions privately, you know, because it's just, it's your ass is on the line and, you know, it's a lot of pressure.
The pressure is enormous, and there's something about it, you know, you have to take it very seriously. I've heard from every actor who's credible I know of, because like you just described, you had to bring three people to life who didn't exist the day before, you know, and you had to inhabit them and make them real and make them different and make them stand out and make them dramatic.
And I have to style them.
Yeah.
I have to figure out, you know, just everything. I also have to take care of me, the actor. And so I always, you know, my thing is I always pack a juice or like a snack pack because you never know if they're running late or whatever. And all of a sudden your, you know, sugar levels are like waning. You're like, oh God, you know, so you need to take care of you. know. And then you got to bring all your makeup and make sure you're powdered. And what headshot are you going to use? And do you have, you know, whatever? And just, oh.
There's something kind of exciting about it, though. I'm sorry. Like, there's just something kind of. It takes a certain type of person, I think, to be on this crazy wild roller coaster that we've decided to embark upon to make up stories and try to bring them to life so people are entertained.
Yeah, now, you got to have a dash of crazy in there, absolutely.
Speaking of the roller coaster stuff, I talk about a lot of genre stuff, especially the last few weeks. We had the Player Piano guys and Tom and Jen from the animation world and everything. And I know I have a fair amount of genre listeners who are probably going, when are you going to ask her about Battlestar Galactica? So
yeah,
please, let's get some. It was a huge monster hit that really brought science fiction into so many onto such another different plane, because I know of so many people who watched Battlestar who were not science fiction fans, who would have watched who loves things like who are now watching House of Cards and Shameless and some of these other dramas. Like, Battlestar was a genuine real drama. Tell us about your experiences on that hit show.
So for Battlestar, yes, I was absolutely a fan of the show. The cast is extraordinary. And what I also loved is, you know, I had friends on there that were leads and now have gone on, you know, Grace Park. Look at her. Like, she's doing amazing, you know, and a really great actress. So that's incredible for a lot of Canadian talent. So there's that aspect. And yeah, I think it was kind of the gateway drug for a lot of people to get into sci-fi. It gave it credibility. And I think, you know, even when I talked to Steven Skaya, my husband, who's a writer, about it, you know, it always comes up in, you know, oh, let's make that show this, you know, let's make it Battlestar. And, you know, everyone's kind of chasing that all the time to recreate something like that, because it was lightning in a bottle. I had gone out for a ton of parts on the show, and I think at one point I even went out and auditioned. It might have even been that day when I went out for those three crazy big roles, because that was the same casting office. But I went out for the prosecutor, I believe, that was the lawyer trying to take Baltar down at some point. And, you know, that character went to someone else. And then finally it was like the show finale, and I went out for this part, and it was cool, because in the script they wanted her to eat a match, which is basically, that means putting a match out in your mouth. And I was like, holy shit, I gotta do that. So one of my biggest tools when I'm preparing is I'll go to YouTube. And I, you know, I'll do as much research as I can in the time I have. So I taught myself how to eat a match. And at first it was a little scary. I'm like, oh my God, am I going to burn my tongue or what? What's happening? So I showed up to the audition, and director Michael Reimer was there. He was doing the finale of Battlestar. And I did. I ate a match right in the audition. And he said, I have to ask you, like, how did you do that? And I was thinking to myself, are you kidding me? Am I the only girl who came in here who actually did it? Like, and
maybe, said, quite frankly,
well,
maybe
it sounded like I was the only one who actually did it. And I said, well, I just watched a YouTube video and I taught myself how to do it. And he was really like intrigued and impressed. And yeah, I was going out for, you know, a lady of the evening, Baltar's girl, a character named Shona, who I ended up getting cast. And that was super exciting. I remember my agent phoned me and I was driving in my car, and I pulled over and she's like, guess what? You finally got, you know, cast on Battlestar. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God. And I just cried. I'm like such a big softy when it comes to happy things. I always just cry with tears of joy.
That's awesome, though.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was a really big win for me. And working with James Callis, who is just an incredible actor, Trisha Helfer. I mean, she's just stunning and amazing. The whole experience was out of this world. Wow. Bad pun, but it really was great.
No,
so,
that's awesome.
Yeah, it meant so much. I mean, just to sneak in there, too, just for the finale, it was like, oh, yeah. But it's super cool.
Now, is Battlestar what they fly you over to Europe for, to meet the fans?
No, so...
What are you famous for over there?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of the sci-fi
I'm
stuff.
I'm sure a lot
sure,
of... But, you've signed some Shona autographs, I'm sure, over the course.
Yeah,
I
get fan mail for a few shows, but I think the biggest one is Stargate. So I was on right. Stargate. I appeared in season 7, 8, and 9. And so, yeah, I was flown over to England last spring. And I was one of a handful of guests to do my very first Stargate convention. And that was super exciting.
That's right. You know, I feel terrible about that. Stargate was something that always slipped through my sphere of influence. And it's always one of those things of like, I'm going to go back and catch up on Stargate one of these years. And I just haven't yet. So I totally apologize for spacing on that. But that's right. You were, you had people like waiting. I mean, you were a big, huge celebrity at this Stargate convention, weren't you?
It was pretty cool. I mean, it, I guess, was a smaller convention in the way of conventions. This one had 400, I think. People at it, which is still big. I mean, when you're sitting on stage and you're looking out at a sea of heads. but yeah, it was a lot of fun. I got to meet with a lot of fans, take pictures with them, do autographs, be on panels, connect with other great actors who have now become good friends of mine. Whenever I go back to Vancouver, we have like a kind of like a Stargate reunion, so that's a lot of fun. Yeah, but the fans are so awesome. I mean, they're so gracious and kind and funny. And yeah, it's fantastic. And I had people shouting, you know, like, oh, you should come to Paris and you should come here. And I'm like, absolutely, sign me up. So I really hope to do more conventions for sure.
Wow, that's awesome. Now, one of the fears about doing these, I mean, to have that kind of success is really awesome. Please don't count the number of heads at a convention, because if I get 400 people to the Handsome TMD Express convention, I'm psyched. That'll be out of this world, taking your bad pun. But yeah. Was there ever a fear of, sometimes this happens in the sci-fi world, of getting typecast? And being like, oh, no, well, she's a sci-fi actress. We can't. Have you run into that at all? But it sounds like probably not, since you're doing, you know, Life Partners sounds about as far away from some of that stuff as possible.
Yeah, I've managed to kind of fall into quite a few genres and niches things. I do a lot of action, which is awesome. And then I do comedy, which is fantastic. And then, you know, I've been able to portray a lot of lesbian roles, which is also really cool. And I feel, you know, it's about time we got more progressive with our portrayals of people and, you know, embracing like the fabric of the world, because it's just the way it is. No, I never feel typecast.
Great. Well, that's definitely good. A lot of really great lessons were talked about today, and I think the Battlestar Galactic story is a great one as far as like the resilience of keep trying. You know what I mean? Like you're gonna get if you know. I say to a lot of people who sometimes like I'm thinking about getting in the business. Get ready for no. Get ready. Hope you love the sound no, because you're gonna get a lot of no's. No, over and over again. And if you can take it, then you will sooner or later hear that yes. And you were able to get right in at, you know, what was one of the biggest finales of the past 10 years, quite frankly.
Yeah. And one of my favorite quotes that I love to say to people when they're like, oh, I haven't been cast in 2 years. You know, I don't know if I'll ever act again. And, you know, there's this great quote that says, you had sex once, you'll have it again. Yeah. And I just love that. It, you know, keeps me warm. It's such a funny quote, but it's really true. And I even say that to myself if ever I'm like, oh, man, let's get working here.
I don't know of anybody who hasn't been through a dry spell in the business, you know? Like when people say, even guys like, you know, oh, my God, Morgan Freeman did 5 movies this year. He knows what that dry spell feels like. So when he gets 5 offers, he's taking them. you know, we all go through that dry spell. And when they occur, that's usually where I think a lot of the attrition in the business happens, when people are like, you know something, I can't hang on anymore. I got to go. I got to find a real job, which, God forbid, I've been able to avoid that for about a good 12 years now. So,
yeah, but maybe those dry spells are like the tsunami. It's like you can't, you know, it's like it feels like nothing's happening, and then you're just like, whoa, you know. There's so much to learn during those times about yourself, about the craft, about other people and the business and all those things. Like, you should just be constantly enriching yourself. As an actor, I would say to myself, okay, every year you have to, I mean, it's not like, okay, self, but, you know, every year I would make a point of learning three different special skills. Mm. So it was like, okay, so I taught myself ukulele. I, you know, learn how to skateboard. I, you know, do pole dancing. I do all these different things, because you just want to have as much in your repertoire. Travel, you know, you just want to be able to draw upon any experience and observation that you can gather from the world. And so be curious about yourself, be curious about other people. Do not live in a bubble. Get out there, you know, see theater, see films, you know, catch up on all the latest TV shows, whatever you need to do.
That's such great advice for writers too. And it's hard for us, because we have to be sort of chained to the keyboard, but we're not chained to the keyboard 24/7. Okay. We're not chained to the keyboard 8 hours a day. We can get out. I think that's so important and true. For writers too, you never know what it happens all the time. And when you start to, once you get past like three or four scripts and you're into like the couple dozens and you're writing scripts, you will literally be like, oh my God, I had a conversation with Simone about ukulele playing 2 years ago. That's exactly what this party scene needs. I need somebody, you know what I mean? You just never know. So even for actors, like you're talking about drawing from that experience for a performance, that's true for us too, I think, for writers. Pulling in for material and everything, you know?
Yeah, like go to a strip club if you haven't, you know?
I will. I will. You got it right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, let's go tonight, Jumbo. No, but it's just...
Let's go to a real strip club.
But
I like Jumbo. Jumbo's is fun, but it's not a real strip club.
Yeah, like, if you agree with it or not, you know, just explore.
You can
stay at home and watch documentaries or whatever. But, you know, it was interesting, even going to that Foxcatcher screening the other night, director Bennett Miller, he said, because they were like, oh, how did you get the idea for this, you know, true life script? And it was like, well, someone handed me a bunch of newspaper articles. And, like, the newspaper is fantastic. Yeah. I mean, because really, truth is stranger than fiction. There's some bizarre things that happen out there that you can't believe. But it happened.
That's where Breaking Bad came from.
Really?
So I got excited. Yeah, they read a newspaper article about a guy who was, I don't remember it exactly for sure, but I think it was a teacher who's, it was very similar. Somebody's insurance was running out, and they became a drug dealer to make some money. But he didn't become a kingpin or anything. He didn't become Heisenberg, but that was where it started. I think that's absolutely right. You never know what's going to spark, and so have your eyes and ears open. I think it's interesting with the research. I think sometimes writers use research almost as a crutch to be like, oh, I got to do more research until I can't start writing yet. Doing more research, you know, anything to not write. But I think I love talking to actors and directors, because they bring up research and preparation much more so than other writers do. I read too many screenplay articles and too many screenplay things that deal with only what happens when you're at the keyboard. And I don't agree with that at all. I think there's so much that happens in screenwriting when you're away from the keyboard, when you're actually like, I mean, shit, the award-winning script I wrote last year came from a documentary I saw in 2002. And I didn't get to writing it because it took that long to, you know, formulate and all that kind of stuff. So I think what you just laid down is absolutely 100% vital, quite frankly, to anybody who wants to be an artist.
Yeah. And there's another cool tip as well. And this was more of an acting tip, but maybe you could use this as a writer as well, which is, if someone were to overhear your conversation in the script and believe that it's real, like that it's actual words coming out of someone's mouth, then you know you're kind of in the right place.
Wow, that's a great tip. No, that's a fantastic tip for writers.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's funny. Like people often talk about, do you write in a cafe? I can't write in a cafe because I literally talk out loud. I say the things as I'm typing them. I say them when I rewrite them. People will call the police if I write in a cafe because I'm saying them too much. And I think you're absolutely right. It should absolutely, does it sound real when you say it back? You don't have to act it out as a writer, but you can still say it and you'll know, you'll have an idea of, well, does that ring true?
Yeah.
Would somebody just say that as opposed to thinking about it?
Well, and also, you know, when I get the script, I'm like, nobody talks like that. You know, like, oh, God, you know. Yeah.
And we all get that note, writers. It's okay. It's something to fix. And we all do that, too. I think every single writer makes that mistake.
Yeah. And another good tip as well is, you know, if you don't want to be at a cafe to write, try having music on. You know, you could even put on Pandora or whatever and have movie soundtrack music that's just instrumental. Steven does that all the time, and I know other writers, very successful writers, that do that as well.
Not only do I think you should use soundtrack music, I have, honestly, I think I do have to do an inventory. It's well over 300 soundtracks, I believe. I think I do exactly what you just described. I only listen to soundtrack music when I write, and classical. But listen to soundtracks that are like the movie you're writing. You know what I mean? If you're writing an action movie, go ahead and put Raiders of the Lost Ark on. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Get that rousing feeling going. Get that mood going. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I want to end on something. We're touching a little long, but I want to end on something that I think is really interesting, because I think it's possibly also one of the best piece of advice you gave. And, you know, actors like Peter Sellers and one of the doctors, John Pert, we often talk like this, and you touched upon it a bit. I'd love to just end on, this might be a good note to end on, which is the idea of being honest and finding yourself. A lot of actors have talked about that struggle of, who am I? And what is that identity? And who is that real person kind of thing? And it sounds like you getting in touch with that has been a huge help and boost to your career. And I think that's just, I've heard a saying once that actors kind of have to be naked and the part is the clothes they put on. You know, you use that very literally. And is that sort of true? Do you think that's something that is helping you as you become more experienced as an actor or actress, that you're becoming more honest and more in touch with who Simone Bailey really is helping you become a better actor, actress?
I think so. Yeah. I think trusting myself as an actor is a big piece. And also, I remember someone once saying about Catherine Keener. Catherine Keener, when she was doing being John Malkovich, now, she was the love interest, but she was not necessarily likable.
No, I was just about to say she was so mean in that movie. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's something to be said about allowing yourself as the actor to allow yourself to not be necessarily likable.
Yeah.
And giving yourself that freedom is really interesting. And so, yeah, being myself, being in touch with all aspects of myself, I'm a very kind person, but I can still get very upset and, you know, feel very aggravated and all those things. So tapping into all those aspects of yourself and joining that with observations you have of people in your life or people that you've seen or people that you've researched. It all is part of the recipe of making your character and your performance dynamic, I think.
Outstanding. I think this has been a really very informative hour for, you know, any aspiring screenwriters or any screenwriter that might be stuck on a script or stuck on a spot somewhere. Take a look at your character motivation, and hopefully this will have helped you out. Simone, I can't thank you enough for taking time out and being on the show.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Oh, it was wicked fun. This was a great one. And go see Life Partners. It's going to be out in theaters this week on Friday, December 5th. If it's not at your local cinema, have no fear. It's 2014, so you can hop online and go to iTunes. And I believe it's available for rental right now. So keep an eye out. It's a great topical comedy. And Simone Bailey, thanks again so much for joining us. Lots of cool, fun stuff coming up on the next few weeks. This is Tim Davis with the Handsome Timmy D Express.